thoughts and answer in a calm manner, if it's at all possible. There's so much screaming going out there on out there now. There's so much hatred. I know it's so important to keep calm in our homes, to keep it peaceful and calm in our homes. And that's what detachment is doing. It's easing us into being comfortable with reality. Over time, I've noticed that one of the most important things I can do for myself in my own life, and that other people can do, is have their goals, to know where they want to go and to continue moving forward. We're either moving forward or we're moving backwards. And which way do we want to go?
If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit Encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Please like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, take care of your most important relationship, you. Detach with love and look inward. Identify what you want and how you feel. To give to others, you have to first give to yourself. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges.
I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We'll bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Randy Zimmerman of WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Today on Sprouts, we'll hear bits from what we at WMNF call Podcasts for Justice. Today, local teens will share how they grapple with issues of emotional, physical, and mental health. We'll also hear from one of more than 100 activists in the Tampa Bay area working on housing insecurity. And we'll hear from a local historian about what Juneteenth means in their community. But first, here's about sustainability project Suki 222.
Thank you for tuning in to Avenue 222 podcast. We're talking about the most essential, the most important, and the most widespread needs in the world and offering solutions. We're talking to experts in all fields, all disciplines, all areas of the world. Our focus is using a base formula, what I call the 222 priority mechanism or algorithm, of 2 gallons of clean water per person per day, 2,000 nutritional calories, and 200 cubic feet of secure shelter. And I want to start by introducing you, David, professor and the director of the Center for Advanced Food Security and Healthy Communities. David is a nutritional anthropologist with expertise in maternal child nutrition, growth and development, food security, dietary exchange, and community nutrition programming. He has conducted research in Costa Rica, Lesotho, India, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Kimmel Green has served as chair, Department of Anthropology at University of South Florida, is one of the largest, if not the largest, in the world, with over 30 professors that are contributing. In 2015, David collaborated with Feeding Tampa Bay and local organizations on multiple food insecurity projects. Dave has 100 plus scientific publications and has received research funding from the National Science Foundation, the United States Department of Agriculture, UNICEF, and the Fulbright Program, as well as various state agencies and private and corporate foundations. David, you and I met a couple of years ago, and I was talking about the need to start measuring food, water, and shelter using Formula 222, and we'll get into that. But I wanted the listeners to hear a bit about how you actually got into this path of how to feed the Tampa Bay community. And it wasn't here in the Tampa Bay area you started. You've done a lot for the community, and you've made a good career for yourself. Can you maybe tell us about how you got to this point?
Sure. Well, thank you, Charles, for having us here today. And so I've been involved in food insecurity and health research for almost 3 decades now, going back to when I was a student. That's been a lot of my focus, starting with work in India and then eventually my PhD research in Lesotho in southern Africa. And then after I finished my PhD, I went on to work for a community-based organization in Connecticut, the Hispanic Health Council. And that's where I started doing a lot of community nutrition research with local leaders there, as well as colleagues from the University of Connecticut. And back in 95 or 96, we testified before the Connecticut State Legislature about the importance of focusing on food security. At that time, it was still a new concept. And Connecticut was the first state, to my knowledge, the first state in the U.S. to establish a Department of Food Insecurity in their agricultural division. So that was really, I think, important for us because we had some impact on policy. And then in 98, I came to USF, and you mentioned some of the things I've done before.
Has that program continued
and grown? Yes, it's the Connecticut Family Nutrition Program was started then. It's still in existence today, and that's one thing we're really happy about. It's been 25 years, and I left Connecticut in 98, and so it's great to see that people took over that program, and it's thriving now.
That's outstanding.
Yeah.
Oh, that's going to lead us to your latest founding of an organization.
Right. So in 2015, actually a little bit earlier, I started working with Feeding Tampa Bay. As a lot of folks know, Feeding Tampa Bay is the major food bank in Tampa Bay. It provides services, food assistance to 10 counties on this side of Florida. One of the things that really impressed me about Feeding Tampa Bay is that while it is an organization that provides food to people, they realize that's not going to solve the issue of food insecurity by itself. And it's a much more complex issue, that it's structural, and that you can theoretically end hunger, but it's not just going to involve providing emergency food assistance. Starting to work with Feeding Tampa Bay, we've collaborated on probably more than 10 projects, evaluations, program development. Some of the projects that, well, you'll hear about today, for example, the Food as Medicine program, food prescription, is one that Chris Ann has been doing a lot of work on. So it's been a really great partnership. And as a result of that partnership, we've worked with other organizations like Tampa Family Health Centers, like Where Love Grows, which is an after-school program. We've done research on food insecurity and health among older adults. We've done research on teen food insecurity. In fact, the research on teen food insecurity led to some policy changes in Pinellas County with regard to food insecure students. And specific activities that take place in the cafeteria when kids are either ineligible free or reduced lunch, or they're eligible, but they're not enrolled. One of the policies that was changed, that those kids before were given something to eat. It was just a cheese sandwich, though. It marked them. Everybody else knew that they were probably poorer kids, since it was stigmatizing. But after we did this project, the county then changed the policy, and those kids who don't have money to buy lunch in the cafeteria or are not in the free or reduced lunch program get the same exact meal as other kids. So this is an example how research leads to action, leads to policy change.
That was Charles Halsoppel of Suki 222 talking with David Himmelgreen about the Center for Food Security and Healthy Communities. Next, we'll hear from Marla Batista of the Batista Project. In this pilot podcast, Marla explains from where she derives her inspiration and motivation to make life on the streets for others just a bit easier.
You're listening to the Advocacy and Empowerment Podcast, produced at WMNF Studios in Tampa, Florida. On this show, we discuss the issues that lead to homelessness, highlight the stories of our friends who are living on the streets, and seek out effective strategies that move them to sustainable housing. If you're interested in joining and being part of the solution, make sure to follow and subscribe. Hope is the CEO of Creative Bay, a copy and content company focused on social impact. She is also an executive board member at the Bautista Project.
And Marla is co-founder of the Bautista Project. She is also a speaker, author, and military spouse. This is part one of a four-part series. Let's start with your story. How old were you when you found yourself homeless, and how did you end up there?
I was actually 18 when I found myself homeless, and I ended up there after years of abuse. I originally am from Watts, California. I was born there, and I lived there in the early 80s, and my mother decided that she no longer wanted to live there around 1992. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1989. And there was a lot of tumultuous things that were happening in LA in the late 80s, early 90s. And my mother, her diagnosis for breast cancer was pretty grim. The outlook wasn't good. Unfortunately, her prognosis was death. And she said she didn't want to die in LA. So she decided to move with my stepfather to Colorado. Now, rewind back prior to that, my biological father and my mother were married when I was born, and they were divorced fairly quickly. And in 1989, I lost my biological father. I was about 6 years old, and he died from HIV, which was kind of a big thing in LA in the late 80s. And my mother remarried. And when she remarried, she had children in her new relationship. And fast forward again to 1989, she was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was pregnant with my younger sister. And we ended up moving to Colorado from California. And that was a really hard thing for me as a child, because my entire life was in California. My whole family was there. And moving to Colorado, we moved there in August of 1992. At that point, her cancer had progressed. She had a double mastectomy, chemo, radiation, all of those things worked for a short period and later failed. So she was admitted into a nursing home to live out the rest of her days. In May of 1993, she passed away. I was 9 years old. That was probably the worst time in my life, not only because of the passing of my mother, but also my biological father had passed away a few years prior. And 3 weeks before my mother passed away, I lost my grandmother to cancer as well, which was her mother.
That's a lot. That's a lot for anybody. And you were nine.
I was 9 years old. So pretty much my whole world was gone. My grandmother was my best friend. My mother, she was my everything. My biological father, although he wasn't in my life, he was still my biological father. And, you know, so my world kind of was flipped upside down at a very early age. When my mother, prior to her passing, she wanted to make sure that I had a place to stay when she passed away. She proceeded to get court papers to have me adopted by my stepfather. My stepfather was abusive prior to my mom's death. I am not sure if she was aware of that. As of May of 1993, I was his child. I was adopted by him. I was sexually assaulted for a long time until I was 18 years old. And when I turned 18 years old, I was kicked out onto the streets with nothing but a trash bag full of clothes.
Was that his call to kick you out on the street at 18, or was that you getting away?
So it was a mixture of both, I want to say. The situation arose because I asked if I can go on a date with a guy. Mm. I was 18 years old. I felt like it was my time. I was an adult. I had a job. I was pretty responsible. And that kind of sent him spiraling, my stepfather. And I was not allowed to go on a date. I kind of didn't understand why. But he said, if you go on this date, you cannot come back to my home. And I said, well, I'm 18 years old. And so I'm allowed to go on dates now. And so I went on the date. I went to a carnival with a guy. And I stayed out all night. And the next morning, my best friend and her mom were driving down my street. And she said, "Hey, are you guys moving?" And I was like, "No, why would you ask me if we're moving?" She's like, "Because I see a whole bunch of trash bags on the curb of your house, and your teddy bear Cookie is outside on top of the trash bags." And I was like, "Really?" And so Cookie is...
That's that your that, special bear that's from my, your mom, right?
Yes, yes, that's my special bear. Cookie was given to my mom at her baby shower when she was pregnant with me. That was the only thing that I had left from my childhood. That was the only thing that I had from my mom.
You can hear more about Marla Bautista and the Bautista Project on WMNF's podcast page. You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. Today's show is featuring snippets of Podcasts for Justice, produced at WMNF in Tampa. Next, we'll hear from Saba Batiste, the host of Fire and Ice, about the enculturation of Africans and Caribbeans in the United States. She's talking with Donald Dowridge, a local historian, about the meaning of Juneteenth for the community.
Juneteenth, that's a holiday that is one of the oldest holidays in America, but just recently in 2021, it became a federal holiday, Juneteenth. And so what Fire and Ice podcast decided to do is that we want to interview people and see what they know about Juneteenth and see how they celebrate it and actually just what it means to them. And because it was it became a national holiday, how would that be different? So today we have this esteemed Mr. Donald Dowridge. He is an awesome portray of Frederick Douglass, and he's an author, he's a lecturer, and he's a motivator. He's just all around great person. And so I think it's so appropriate to get his opinion on Juneteenth. What Mr. Dowridge is saying is so important to history. This is information that is documented that he's sharing with us. And so please listen and remember that this was back in the time where they told us Black people didn't matter and that we were enslaved and we were only good to be slaves. But there was this huge figure called Frederick Douglass that really is, we can contribute his works to our freedom as well as anybody else. Okay, so I'm going to let Mr. Dowridge complete his portray of Frederick Douglass and tell us documented information about the Juneteenth surrounding events.
Thank you. That eventually, yes, General Granger made his way to Galveston, and those slaves that were there, they were indicated that they were free. Now, the downside of that, you know, when they indicated that we were free, such as in 1863, when they said we were free, there were a number of us who refused to leave the plantation. And the reason, as it is recorded, that they refused to leave because, A, they had no knowledge. They had no education of how to step out on their own. So they were frightened to move out and begin a life on their own. And that's the downside. And even further, even though they were free and they were still working on the plantation, they were not reaping financial rewards, such as because of the fact that the master said, "Wait a minute, I'm feeding you. I'm clothing you. I'm housing you. So that means I'm taking your pay out of this. So you don't get any financial pay." So, and then you got to understand that even when we were enslaved, there were a portion of us who loved our master. You know, we loved our master. So, you know, live and die for the master instead of being, you know, brave enough to step out, if you will, on their own. So, when you mentioned Frederick Douglass, which I have been portraying around the country since 2009, yes, he was a strong opponent in agreement to bring slavery to an end. And it was just that you would call it his bravery. He was a very brave, you know, black man back then to do some of the things that he did, knowing that he was putting his life at risk. For instance, you know, being friends with John Brown. That right there could have got him killed. Writing his book, The Narrative and Life of Frederick Douglass, that could have got him killed. Going to the White House and having talks with President Lincoln could have also got him, you know, killed. Now, after President Lincoln was assassinated, his vice president, Vice President Johnson became president. Mm-hmm. President Johnson had no love for Frederick Douglass.
I want to ask you a question, you know, because history tells, some types of history tell us a different story, but you're absolutely right that, matter of fact, some things were retracted mm-hmm. because of the assassination and because of the support that Frederick Douglass had for those things. There was supposed to be a lot of things come to the slaves that was retracted after mm-hmm. the assassination.
Yes.
So this story is big, right? Juneteenth is not just a holiday. It tells a full story of where we come from in that whole diaspora as we went through the slave journey and the chattel slavery. And so we land in a place where slavery is abolished, but we're impoverished.
Yeah, we're impoverished, and we're impoverished in a great sense.
That was Saba Baptiste with Donald Dowridge Jr. from the Fire and Ice podcast. In this last segment, we'll hear local teens learning to share their thoughts and feelings about tough subjects through podcast production. In this podcast, through interviews and conversation with each other, they tackle what healthy means for them. I ask the first question to model interviewing, then the students pick up the task with their counselor, Tokara Jackson, followed by them asking each other about personal health. What were the things that when you designed your curriculum, you really wanted to drive home to make sure that your students learned?
So I wanted to really take away some of the things that are taught in the media and on TV are it's false.
Like what?
A lot of the things, so they teach you about nutrition. They say low fat, no sugar, things like that. Everything has sugar in it. They say no sugar, but I teach reading the back of the label. Sucralose is sugar. So if you see sucralose in everything that says no sugar, it has it in it. Also teaching them about breakfast. Breakfast is it means breaking a fast. It means break fast. So you fast it while you were sleeping. So the first meal of the day, they teach you that it could be sugary cereal or pork, bacon, and all, like eggs. Like all of that is what they label as breakfast. And that's not necessarily what you have to eat as breakfast foods. A lot of the time they say, they teach kids to eat a healthy meal before they do testing. But then you go to the school and they give them processed food and sugary food. That's not the healthy meal that they should be eating to get their brains focused for testing. So that's a lot of the things that I teach the kids.
How did your mental health affect you studying for your master's degree?
Oh, good question. I took what I experienced in my childhood and I knew that I wanted to help people. And so I did a career change. First, I wanted to be a nurse. I was like, oh, this is going to work. I'm going to be able to help people. I'm going to be able to help kids. And then COVID happened and I was like, no, this is not for me. And so then I'm like, what else can I do to be able to help? And so I fast tracked myself. I already had credits from, of course, my other degree. So I say I can be a social worker. This will be great. And so I went and I did my bachelor's. And then after that, I was talking to a few people and they were like, no, you'll be great. I'll be a great therapist. You can use your life experience and your education to help these youth. I was like, sounds great. So I went to do my master's. In between that, another program came up for mental health for adolescents. I was like, I'm going to do both of them at the same time and work. It was challenging because I had 4 jobs and 2 master's programs. And some days these mental health breaks were necessary. Some days I couldn't get up. I'm like, I just need a break. It's so much. I'm just going to lay here. And I'm not going to do any work. I'm not going to do any schoolwork. I just can't do anything. And sometimes I felt like I need to give up. I need to quit. But then I looked at the goal, the why of why I was doing what I was doing. And I'm like, this is going to be beneficial to others. It's only going to be a short amount of time. And I'm like, this stress, this schooling, all of these things that happen is going to be for this amount of time. I'm going to look back and be frustrated if I quit. So I just kept going and kept going. And working with you all motivate me. I'm like, okay, I can see the need. I can see where I need to do, where I need to be. I'm going to keep doing it because I knew you guys were watching me. Right. And so when people are watching you, you behave differently. Right. And so I just kept motivating myself to keep going. And now I'm done.
How do you stay mentally healthy and stable?
I have a whole regimen. So first thing first is cut off anything that alters my emotions, my well-being, me feeling safe and healthy. So if that's cutting people off, distancing myself from people who trigger me or causes me to not be my best self. Things that simple as putting my phone on do not disturb at 9 p.m. If you have an emergency, you call 911, you pray, or you go to God or whatever, but you won't be able to reach me at the 9.
How do you feel about therapy?
This is a good question. I feel that therapy is a good asset. I know for a lot of people of color and communities of color, therapy is kind of taboo because of the stigma that is attached to it. But therapy is good because you have a way to get things off your chest without being judged and from someone who's unbiased to your situation. And sometimes, you know, there's different types of therapy. So there's talk therapy, there's music therapy, there's art, there's different types of therapy. You have to talk to someone to find out what's best for you. So I believe it helps because it gives you an outlet where you may not have had one previously to get everything off.
When you said there was stigma behind therapy and taboo with Black community, what did you mean by that?
So in Black and brown communities, stigma can look differently. So when you see someone who has mental health, first thing people say, oh, are they crazy? And then that automatically make you feel ashamed, right? Guilt. I don't want to go talk to anyone because they're going to think I'm crazy. And not all mental health means psychotic or bipolar. It could be anxiety. It could be depression. It can be grief. It could be different things. And so the stigma alone of, which is negative attributions or negative thoughts around something, can keep you from getting the help you need.
Okay. And last question is, are you okay?
Yes, I am very okay. I'm excited about this interview.
Thank you.
How do you feel about therapy?
I've been to therapy, but not like a real therapy because we have a school counselor in our schools, but honestly, I don't really trust them because, I don't know, I just never really trust the school counselors. But my therapy is God and my mom, and that's just like my most important therapy, and they help me a lot. My mom helps me a lot, gives me good advice, and God always helps my spirit feel better too.
What do you do during your mental health breaks?
What I do on my mental health breaks is I journal, I read, and I clean my room. And it's always good to do a little reset in your room because a clean room is like a clean mind. So it's always healthy to have a clean room too. And it's also a good space for your mental health.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to WMNF's Podcast for Justice. Our contributors this week were Charles Halsoppel, Marla Batista, Hope Turner, Saba Baptiste, Zaniah Anderson, Edwin Costa, Jakivia Mickleton, Gianna Pringle, Dinesia Cotton, Alina Farrell, Zariah Anderson, Elena Farrell, and LaShannon Ralph. Production assistance came from Wade Jones, Dwayne Terry, and Rhonda Flowers of the Skills Center, Tampa. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rutenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula at pacifica.org. I'm Randy Zerman at WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is conducting a survey, and we want to hear from you. Your valuable feedback about KBOO will help shape the types of public affairs, news, and music programming we bring you and our community in the years ahead. We're also interested in how you listen to KBOO, and we'll use this feedback to help serve you better. The survey is anonymous, however, you will have an opportunity to provide your contact information to enter a drawing. 10 lucky winners will receive a $50 gift card. The survey is open now, and the deadline to participate has been extended to Sunday, July 30th. Go to our website at kboo.fm/survey23. kboo.fm/survey23. Thank you in advance for your time and your feedback. Stay tuned for KBOO's next strategic plan coming soon.